What's that, boy?
I want to tell you about your girlfriend.
What about my girl?
But you don't look strong enough to take the message.
I'm strong enough.
I might hurt your feelings.
My feelings already hurt by being here with you.
Well, I was walking down the street with your girl the other day.
Uh-huh.
And the wind was blowing real hard.
Is that right?
That's Bo Diddley, but we're not playing that because of Bo Diddley. We're playing that because this is Lady Bo's birthday. Lady Bo, the queen of Afropunk. She was, every time you hear Bo Diddley and you hear that incredible lead guitar, it's not Bo Diddley. It's Lady Bo. So she was born on this day in 1940, and she's still playing and making great music. So happy birthday, Lady Bo. That's part of our day in history. You know, we always give you pieces of music that are associated with this day in history. And we have a day in history coming up this Friday that is not a happy day in history. That is the day that Tyrone West died while in the hands of the police. We've been covering the Tyrone West situation since the beginning with the family, with the prosecutors, with the police, with community members. And on this day, we're going to remember that and talk about it. We'll have members of the family coming in towards the end of the show. We are now joined here in the studio by the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, who is pastor at the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore and a leading community activist. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Good to have you here always. And Stephen Janis is in the studio, an award-winning investigative reporter at WBFF-TV, author of You Can't Stop Murder, Truths About Policing in Baltimore and Beyond, and Why Do We Kill the Pathology of Policing in Baltimore, with former homicide detective Kevin Selwell. Good to have you with us in the studio.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Got to raise his mic. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can join us on our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Write to me at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts as we approach this anniversary, first anniversary of the death of Tyrone West. 410-319-8888. And Heber Brown, I just, you know, let me ask you first. I mean, your reflections on this, and I wouldn't be surprised if this is even part of something you may say next Sunday, mm-hmm. as you sit on the pulpit. Knowing your what you think about it. I mean, what are you thinking about at this moment?
Well, my prayers for the family continues, and I continue to be inspired by this family as well. Honestly, I marvel at the way that they share their grief and their passion for justice in this city, and I believe that they may be setting a new paradigm for how families organize in the face of these kinds of injustices. Coming from more of a community activist background, I've not seen in all my years in Baltimore a family as organized, strategic, and committed as this family. And so I pray that the community rallies around this family and learns from them. They are the unfortunate teachers of how to engage some of the issues of injustice in this city.
Steve Janis, you've been covering this.
Mm-hmm.
There are missing components here.
Well, there's a lot of missing components. Obviously, the report from the commissioner, which is he started this sort of, with the Anthony Anderson case, this idea of having an outside group look at the actual, you know, arrest and what led up to his death. And also, you know, they did not bring this before a grand jury. I mean, State's Attorney Greg Bernstein decided to handle this case internally. So there's several aspects and components of this. But, you know, what the Reverend said is absolutely true. You know, I've covered these types of cases for years, and I've never seen a case where the family put constant pressure from all sort of political, you know, institutions on the police department and the mayor. And I think it has had an impact on how these cases are handled. And I certainly think this case had an impact perhaps on the state's attorney's election. So it's been a major, major case.
I do want to talk about the state's attorney's race as well in just a moment. But and what were you saying earlier about the effect you think it may have had on the mayor, the comments you were making?
Well, it was interesting. You know, I covered, there was a press conference last week with the mayor and the police commissioner regarding the drop in the homicide rate to 100. And the message was quite different from years past, which was we've been working with the community. They kept crediting the community. And both the commissioner and the mayor were saying, we've reached out to community involvement, community this, community that. Now, 4 or 5 years ago, the message was VSET. It was an aggressive, targeted offender, targeting the worst offenders, but a message of very aggressive policing, which was really part of the Biefeld era, which was, you know, we need VSET in all neighborhoods. We're going to go after these criminals. But then you sit in this press conference, you wonder, now, why has this changed so dramatically in a couple years, where the mayor is basically saying this – we're going to work with the community. The reason that the homicide rate is down is not because we've sent, you know, specialized units in the neighborhoods, but because the neighborhoods are working with us. And that's an entirely different message than I've ever heard before as a reporter.
What does that say to you, Heber? The reality, from your perspective of hearing that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because I think, you know, Janice is right in the message that we constantly hear from City Hall and from the police department about, you know, the community needs to work with us. We need to work with us, work with us. And almost shaming the community, attempting to anyway, shame the community into partnership. But I was thinking on the way here that even in light of those types of strong arming into partnership from City Hall and from the police department, it almost comes with this silent agreement that the community must cooperate and partner with the police department, but don't mention anything about police misconduct. Don't mention anything about allegations of abuse in the police department. And I'm just, I mean, frankly, I am unwilling and I'm hesitant to be a part of those joint community police ventures because I'm not willing to sign the, you know, unspoken agreement that I have to march for public safety and peace in our streets, but don't say anything about the fact that there are allegations of police misconduct in this city. And so be silent about Tyrone West. Don't say anything about Anthony Anderson. Be quiet about George King. Don't raise these issues, but let's walk together. And as much as the community has heard over the years about, you know, we need to stop this, you know, stop snitching culture in Baltimore, some would say the police department has, with their blue wall, they have the same type of code of conduct. That there's silence, that you don't say anything. There are officers, more than one officer, in many of these incidents that are raised. But you don't hear from them or, you know, we don't hear other reports. And then, of course, the Civilian Review Board, they are perfunctory and powerless roles, so much so that even they are saying, we're tired of this. It's a toothless tiger that, you know, is said to be helping to address these issues, but doesn't seem to be doing anything at all.
And I wonder what it says about what we mean by policing and how we're supposed to police our communities. I mean, when I was reading an article that came out last January in which they interviewed Corinthia Severance, who was the young woman who was with Tyrone West on the day that he died. And she was saying that Tyrone West was saying, you got me, stop hitting me. And that she was saying, it's a natural instinct. You want to ward off people trying to hit you. But then when he gave up, he was saying, stop hitting me because I've given up now. And I know actually, it's from personal experience, this is a long time ago, then the same thing, exact thing after the police got you and they have you up in the air and they have you handcuffed and then they start beating and hitting you and you're going, well, you got me. Stop hitting me. Start yelling at them, but it doesn't make a difference. They're going to keep on hitting you. That's part. The difficult thing is, in some ways, that's part of police culture, whether it's in Baltimore or San Francisco or Toledo or Jerusalem or London or wherever that is.
Right.
You know, and so do we ever think about how you get to the heart of that?
Well,
how do you get to the heart of that?
It's because we pick policing as a solution to many, a myriad of social problems. And I mean, Baltimore City, we did an analysis, is the second heaviest policed city in the country. I think per capita, we have the second highest other than D.C. And we dedicate $400 to $500 million towards this idea. But to bring it up or to question it in the past 10, 12 years or to say, bring any sort of context where you're saying, well, is this really the solution, is pretty much derided as wrong. So we have chosen policing to solve these problems, whether it's right or wrong. And I think by accepting, especially on such a heavy basis, you know, you look at the zero tolerance policy during the last decade, where you're arresting 100,000 people per year. I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of people. That's an extraordinary presence of policing, an extraordinary amount of money. So when you choose that, I don't know if you really have any sort of decision to look at the nuances later on.
That's a really interesting point of all this. Heber?
Yeah. And I would think that I would think.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I remember the past decade driving down, for example, Greenmount Avenue and seeing barricades. And almost checkpoints along Greenmount Avenue.
Oh, you mean between the white community and the black community? Is that what you mean?
No.
You're talking about
Well, more so just up and down. This was during the zero tolerance. So more so just late night, you know, the things that happen while you are sleeping.
Gotcha.
In the midst of policing is an issue. And so when you have, Janice says, that type of investment as policing as the solution, and then your accountability arm, I mean, I was just doing a lot of reading about the CRB, the Civilian Review Board today, but your accountability arm has, I think, about, you know, $2 million or less. Well, really, no, it was no budget.
And they have no power.
And they have no power. They review after the internal affairs is already done. There are other models. And so, I mean, I'm thankful to hear people like the mayor and city council members say, we know there's a problem that needs to be some type of external oversight, but we're looking for ideas. Ideas are everywhere. There are independent monitors in some locales, and there are, for some cities, there are civilian lawyers who are directors of internal affairs departments to kind of separate that a little bit. And then even with our current Civilian Review Board, I appreciate them sharing their frustration with elected officials, but perhaps they need to come to community association meetings, because I know, like, in some community association meetings, the police, local police department districts show up to report to the community association, you know, how many larcenies, how many robberies, how many whatever in the community.
Right,
so
right.
There's some type of engagement that happens between community members and local police officers at community association meetings. I wonder what would happen if you introduce Civilian Review Board members to those same meetings and say, here's what we receive from this local district, and have local officers addressing local issues from local people right there at community association meetings. If it does nothing else, it could potentially create a groundswell of community support to say, to have community members putting pressure on local districts, which then leads to pressure on City Hall and the police department. And perhaps there can be just as much marching on the police as there is marching with the police to help tip the balance and get more balance in this whole equation.
I mean, it'd be interesting that maybe think of something to think about, having Civilian Review Board's members, if they would come on the air and talk about the work they're not allowed to do.
Yeah, that would be. I mean, State Delegate Jill Carter introduced legislation a couple years ago to try to fix the internal disciplinary process by using retired judges to make the, you know, trial board, which is the ultimate conclusion of internal disciplinary, more balanced. But it got no traction in Annapolis, and any type of reform in that sense gets nowhere. Literally gets nowhere. So it's very difficult to create an accountability system in a heavily policed city like this.
I'm sorry, you want to say something?
Yeah, which is exactly why I think the pressure has to come from outside of City Hall and outside of the police department. I think the community has to, following the example of the West family, I think the community has to be the ones that puts the pressure on them, because no matter what they say in a press conference, from the police union to City Hall, they're not going to be inspired to really make significant reform. I think it has to come from outside.
Folks, you can join us here. I don't know your thoughts at this. 410-319-8888 as we look at this one-year anniversary coming up on the death of Tyrone West while in the hands of the Baltimore City Police. And just for refreshing our memories, I mean, he was being beaten. The coroner's report said that he medical examiner's report that he died from a heart attack and dehydration as a result. But the part that we don't get, as we other that medical official said on this air on this program after that report came out, was the connection is, no, he didn't just die because he had a heart attack or was dehydrated, even though he might have drank a lot of soda. It's not water, so you get dehydrated even with soda. Is that he would not have died had he not been beaten by the police. If that wasn't taking place at the moment and he wasn't screaming, his heart wouldn't have enlarged and he wouldn't have had the heart attack and died.
Yeah.
So that was made clear by physicians from other places talking about what's not being said about this medical report. So I think that's really important. So whether it was a direct result of the beating or whether it was his heart attack was a result of the beating itself that killed Tyrone West, it was in part what the police did that led to his murder.
And I think, Mark, even in your sharing that, it helps me to just remember the role of media even in these types of issues, right? And so that the media has a role, and that it can help to shield and silence critical analysis and debate on these types of issues, or it can ask the questions and create the platform for just, you know, for discussions and analysis that needs to happen. So, for instance, when I read the headlines in Baltimore City, we often read police involved shooting or, you know, those types of headlines in the newspaper. What that does, police involved shooting, that it deposits some implications and suggestions that does not necessarily place the onus of responsibility and accountability on the police officer. Police involved shooting, right? Mm. In many instances, police were the only ones shooting, or they were the actors, the aggressive actors in the situation. And so what would it be, and Stephen Janis, I know you're know, sensitive to these, but what if the headlines were different in Baltimore to help open eyes to, at the very least, the type of critical debate that's necessary, if not taking a, you know, taking a side, because you want to maintain some objectivity?
I mean, we had a really horrible case 5 or 6 years ago. Was at the Examiner. A young man named Edward Lamont Hunt, I think, was in a shopping center at Northern Parkway.
Yes.
And he was shot in the back and killed. Mm-hmm. And we did 12 to 15 stories, and he was eventually indicted. But what was different about that was that there were a lot of witnesses and a lot of people who saw it and a lot of people willing to come forward. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting about it, and I mean, I think tragic in some sense for the family, was that eventually the officer was acquitted. And I think, you know, certainly the media shares tremendous responsibility for the way we report. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we miss a lot of stuff. In that case, we had witnesses, people we could talk to. But these cases are heavily shrouded, and that's where I think the idea of transparency mm-hmm. is important. But we can't say, okay, it's the fault of police or it's the fault of the city government. I mean, that's our job.
Yeah.
And I think we need to do a better job. I think one of the main things about the West family coming out is that everywhere I went, they were there, whether it be the city council mm-hmm. or a community meeting. I remember a community meeting at Morgan State where there were 7 or 8 family members, and a bunch of media was there, and it really, like, sort of brought that to the fore. So certainly, you know, that concerted sort of effort can help. But I agree the media needs to do a much better job with covering these cases, regardless of excuses. You know, I totally agree with you on that.
So, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Want to hear your voices. We're getting some voices through tweet, by tweeting us, and we're getting voices on the email. But join us here by phone if you can, 410-319-8888. Jackie Robars, I think it's horrific that Tyrone West's family had to wait months for results from the medical examiner's office. Do we know if anything has changed at the medical examiner's office as a result of the outcry for more accountable and real-time MEE's office? The answer on my end is no.
Yeah, I would say no. I mean, I would say that, you know, we know we have a situation with the medical examiner's office, you know, has rules many deaths undetermined where they don't even classify them, and that can stall a lot of investigations. And no, it's very, very difficult as a reporter to get, I will say that unequivocally, to get information from the medical examiner's office. It's very, very difficult. I've tried to deal with some cases where people died in prison, took forever. So no, I don't think that's changed.
And also, I will say there's kind of a class and race issue here involved too, that if a child of somebody who lived in certain neighborhoods in our town, Roland Park or some other places, Mount Washington, died mysteriously, a young woman, let's say, that we would know why she died pretty mm-hmm. soon.
Yes.
A heroin overdose, was it rape, what happened was a combination. But as Jackie Robars has said to me, there are hundreds of women's cases, many of whom were addicts, some were not, that died, and we don't know why.
It's true.
You know, and the results are not out for the families to know why.
We have the highest use of undetermined cases in the country.
Wow.
Right. 300 to 400 roughly in Baltimore City. Many of them, Dr. Fowle will attribute to overdose. But as we could see in California, when a Google executive died, right, from getting a hot shot from an alleged prostitute, that case was quickly turned into a homicide in that circumstance, which is an interesting contrast to what you see here in Baltimore.
Right.
Hundreds of them. It's no exaggeration.
Let's go to the phones and get a comment here. On the way, I'll read this tweet that came in from at Slug45. Gee, it's critical to change the culture of policing through legislation and litigation. Zero tolerance policies for police brutality. It was tweeted in by Slug45G. So 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Rhonda Cooperstein, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rhonda. Welcome.
I just want to recall years ago a case, the case of Juwan McGee. I don't know if anybody remembers it.
Yes.
But he was 12. He was in a pizza parlor. And he pulled out a lighter. He was up at the counter. And he was shot in the back by an off-duty police officer. And there was a big outcry. We had there was a big fundraiser. Gil Scott-Heron came to town, and there was a in-house police trial, which I attended. And, you know, there seemed to be some justice, but as soon as the tension died down, the police officer was reinstated. And sometime later, they tried to press some charges against Juwan McGee. I don't know whatever happened. You know, I think I left town and I lost track of the case. But, I mean, this has been going on for years. And even when the community does rise up and something does happen, as soon as the, you know, things die down, the police just go in and do whatever they want. So I just wanted to recall that this has been going on for a long time.
A very long time.
Which speaks to, I believe, just, you know, the roots of institutional injustice, right? Whether it's gender-based, whether it's race-based, institutional injustice that seem to be at the roots of policing in this country. And as you said earlier, Mark, you talk about whether Jerusalem or whether, you know, wherever around the world. But as you said, Stephen, that there are other alternatives to this. You also said, Stephen, about the implications that the Tyrone West family and their just relentlessness on this issue, mm-hmm. the impact that it might have had on recent local elections. Mm-hmm. I'm curious now, and I don't have an answer to this, but I'm curious now as to what partnership possibilities might exist with the city state's attorney's office now.
Yeah.
Presuming that Marilyn Mosby will cross the line.
I think the main thing is the community to demand that these cases are brought in front of a grand jury, just not from any sort of partial aspect, but just simply to have a neutral body review them. It's something that happened in the past routinely. If you talk to the man who wrote the book with Lieutenant Stephen Tabling, he says, he scratches his head and says, why don't they just bring them to the grand jury? At least in that sense, you know, the responsibility is on the people who are selected on the grand jury, and they don't do it. And it doesn't really make any sense, because that's where all the questions of impartiality come from. And having something after you've issued a letter of declination that says, you know, a report, doesn't really help the family in that sense to feel in any way that the criminal process was fair.
Do you think it's because there's an ignorance about how to even go about bringing something to the grand jury? Or how would we work to just share more information with, you know, everyday regular folks in Baltimore, how to even begin that?
Well, that's the state's attorney's job. I mean, they're the ones refusing to do
right.
it. You know, and we did ask Marilyn Mosby to join us today. She's in court this morning. She couldn't do it. And I think Mr. Navarone is still running, as far as I understand, for office, as far as I know. So I want to get commentary from both of them about how they would handle this and what they would do going in if they became state attorney for the city of Baltimore.
Yeah,
how would they change things?
Every time he had one of his press conferences where he discussed it, Mr. Bernstein, I asked him about the grand jury, and he said no, but he wouldn't really elaborate. But it really is an option for any prosecutor, I would believe. I mean, I'm not a legal expert, but in the past, that's what's happened.
So 410-319-8888. Should we get one caller in before we hit the break? Let's go to Michael. You're on the air.
Yes, Mark. I thought it might be worthwhile to discuss what Greenmount Avenue was like back in the 60s when I lived down in that area and how much it's changed since then. Give a little perspective to this. I grew up around Greenmount Avenue, Preston Street, Valley Street, and we had a grocery store there that was in need of protection because we were robbed many times, and we're lucky to have survived that. However, when I wrote a letter to Pomerleau about the situation there, he came out himself and looked over the environment of the grocery store. He put a police officer on patrol there, and even to stop into the store to sit with us for certain times. And when the riots happened in 1968, we were also there. Now, I should backtrack for a second. It was so dangerous down there. Now, if I came home at night driving a car to park it in front of my house and there'd be teenagers standing out in front of the house, I would have to go to find a police officer in order to be able to get out safely and get into the home. But that gives you a perspective now what happened in the riot. Because now, in 1968, when we had the people burning down stores and homes all throughout the neighborhood, there was one very amazing thing. And that was that the neighbors of who came to our grocery store, who actually patronized it, protected us. They put Soul Sister, because my mother ran the store, on our car, on our home, on the store.
Okay, we do have to take a break here, but I would like to have Heber Brown and see if I have a chance to comment back to our listeners. Do you want to do that right after break or take the break and do it? Do it now? Do it now.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I've heard this before, and I would ask, how has it changed? I mean, how has the solution that we picked, policing, changed the area of Greenmount Avenue since then? You know, and I think that's the problem that we see in this. We all talk about crime, and you know, like my house was robbed recently. But, you know, if policing was the only solution, or if it was, and I would say just from a – I always say it's immune from empiricism, you know. If it really worked, we would have probably the safest city in the country based on the resources we commit to it. So it's just a basic question that I think we have to ask. I'm asking as a reporter.
Right. And I think what the caller's first few words really struck me, talking about a grocery store near Greenmount Avenue. And so I think about even the resources, the institutional resources in that area and in that neighborhood. I was trying to sit here and think, what grocery store is at Greenmount Avenue now? What are the institutional resources? I know there's a Family Dollar that was, you know, a dollar mm-hmm. store or something
right.
that's there. That's the newest institution, the store that I've seen in that area in a long time. And so, you know, I think about what Glenn Ross told me a long time ago. Ghettos are created. And I think about even the systemic policies that go into helping to create a perfect mix, a witch's brew of poor resources that give rise to open rebellion. And that's what I would call it.
And that's part of what happened in 1968 was an open rebellion after the killing of Martin Luther King, and people were just up against the wall and fed up with what was going on. And part of that also was gave the excuse to, I think, the governing community in Baltimore to just abandon the neighborhoods mm-hmm. and leave them behind and let them fall apart so they now can be rehabbed to have and be gentrified in different ways. You know, I think that's when you talk to Eddie Conway about his greatest shock. The size and the same, the police brutality still exists in our community. Was driving down North Avenue after got out of prison and seeing the condition it was in now compared to the condition it was in when he was sent to prison. And he was just overwhelmed by the complete dislocation and utter poverty and waste. He was just shocked. He said it felt like I was coming back to Berlin being bombed after World War II. And that's how he felt looking at where we are today in this community. But we do have to take a break here. But very quickly, so your thoughts on there's a lot of callers calling in. We'll get these calls, some people calling in the next in the next segment when the family joins us in studio. But so where do you think we should go from here? What do you think has to happen now? Who has to answer what does Tyrone West's death mean for the future?
Well, I think it means that, you know, if families keep asking these questions, and I think that it means a reconsideration of the idea of policing and how this city pays and operates a large police force, and maybe hopefully for the first time have a real debate. I mean, as a reporter, I would like to see a real debate, and I think that the family needs to keep pushing for those questions to be answered so that we see, because remember, he wouldn't be dead if the police, I mean, the police turned around, they followed him. You know, the whole scenario was kind of bizarre. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think it raises that fundamental question about the choices we make as a community and maybe have this debate in the political spectrum, you know, more substantively.
I think for me going forward, I think it's important. One of my Twitter followers just said, and I think it's important that Juwan McGee, Tyrone West, Anthony Anderson, Christopher Brown, they're not isolated cases, but it's a part of a web, and we can add so many more names to that. And even over this past weekend, we saw, you know, the second annual 300 Men March down North Avenue. I would love to see just as much energy and focus, while I applaud and appreciate that effort, Munir Bahar and just so many others, Bobby Marvin, wonderful brothers doing great things. I would love to see the same type of effort behind, like, the West family. And not just the West family in particular, but the issue of putting real energy in our local communities to put pressure on local police districts by extension, City Hall and the police departments, because I don't see the answer coming out of City Hall. I think the people will have to organize, rally, and put pressure, just like the West family is teaching us to do.
Right, and we're going to link to some of the articles about Tyrone West's death on our website so you can read them for yourselves after the show. We're about to talk to Tyrone West family members who have come into the studio to talk with us and remembering how this all happened and his driving his sister's Mercedes, taking a young woman who he picked up to take somewhere, being stopped by the police. And they came up with a lame excuse about why they stopped him, about not having the license and all the other stuff, which he did. And, you know, it was also the story of a large, young African-American man driving a Mercedes in the inner city.
Yeah.
That was a big piece of the story. So we'll talk more about that with our with the family coming in. The Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church here in Baltimore and a leading community activist. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much.
Steve Janis is with us, award-winning investigative reporter, author of If You Can't Stop Murder, Truths About Policing in Baltimore and Beyond, and Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Policing in Baltimore. Good to see you again, Steve.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me.
And we're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we'll be joined by members of Tyrone West family to talk about the demonstration they're having this Friday and what they've been doing and what they've heard and learned in this last year. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and reminding you on the way to the second part of our conversation about Tyrone West's death 1 year ago this Friday on the 18th of July. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. And we are joined now, once again, by members of Tyrone West Family Plus One. We're here in the studio once again with Tawanda Jones, who is Tyrone's sister, Jamie Richardson, Tyrone West's cousin, Diana Butler, who is Tyrone's aunt, who helped raise Tyrone as a young man. And also in the studio with us, Abdul Salam, who is a community activist, who was also beaten up by the Baltimore City Police and is suing along with the West family, the Baltimore City Police, and good to see you in the studio as well. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Marie and Beth, we're going to come to your calls coming up. We want to introduce the family first and come right back to the phones at 410-319-8888, so stay with us. So, Tawanda, tell us first, part of one of the reasons you're here, besides what's this horrific anniversary that we are remembering, is what's happening this Friday.
Yeah, this Friday marks a year of the worst day that changed my family's life forever, the anniversary of my brother's death. And my family, we're going to be at Kentmore Road at 6:30 p.m. We was going to do it at 6, but we want to make sure everybody be able to get out there. So we're going to get out there at 6:30.
Well, this is where you died.
Yes.
Kentmore and Calway.
Yeah. Gotcha. So we're going to be there 6:30 this Friday.
And what are you going to do there?
We're going to just kind of like go through and just like basically in solidarity and, you know, just walking through, because that's where my brother took his last, kind of like a candlelight without the candles, but just, you know, just going there.
Now, Abdul Salam, let me introduce you to the audience and talk a bit about, take a quick detour for just a moment for you to talk about your experience, what happened, and the connection here between you and Tyrone West's family.
There's definitely a unique connection between our family and, unfortunately, an ongoing connection. It just shows a microcosm of what's going on in the community. I was beat at my home with my three-year-old son 17 days prior to Tyrone being beat to death. And it's happened two blocks from where Tyrone's tragedy occurred. And like I said, 17 days prior. And two of the three officers that beat me in front of my son and plenty of neighbors and witnesses were the two of 10 officers that were involved in Tyrone's beating.
And who are they? Can you say
Nicholas
their names?
Davis, Chapman, and Ruiz. Yeah. The ones that I've been saying from
George
the door. Who
Omar
saw
West.
You? Yes. From the door. I kept saying, you know, from the beginning of me being on your show and anywhere, letting, you know, advocating that had these two would have been took off the placed behind the desk, took off the street, my brother Tyrone West would still be alive. I have no doubt in my mind that he would still be here. We would not be here on your show today.
And we had to do our own internal affairs type of investigation and putting pieces together to figure out that these two officers indeed were involved in both situations. And it shows the lack of transparency between the community, internal affairs, and the police department and the community and the distrust, because we're telling the city facts that they should be telling us.
Right.
You know, and even when we tell them, they don't, it still, there's no discussion around it. It's just like we're telling them and we get these blank looks.
Mm-hmm.
So could you take us also back? Because I want people to hear this, because we've talked about what happened to Tyrone before we turn to his aunt Diana and to Jamie, his cousin. What happened to you? I mean, what happened in your give our listeners a sense of the story.
On a
what happened
regular routine day for myself, returning home from work, I had my son with me. I pick him up often after schools as I work late hours. So sometimes I'm not even able to pick him up as much as I want to. This particular day, we're shopping for 4th of July items, and we're approaching the home. And as we approach my home, I notice the officers.
You're walking or driving?
No, we're driving.
You're driving.
I'm driving.
Uh-huh.
I'm coming up Northwood Drive, and I see the officers harassing other members of the community. So I proceed. I go into my driveway. I think nothing of it. I'm going into my driveway. My alleyway, if you know Baltimore. I'm turning into my alleyway.
Right.
And as I'm going down, I start to, as I approach my home, I start to see the car racing, police car racing down the alleyway. So I'm like, well, what's going on? It's not normal routine type of situation in this neighborhood. It's not a high crime neighborhood. So they, I pull over in my driveway. They start announcing themselves on the loudspeaker, which drew attention in our community for me to pull to stop the vehicle in the driveway. I did. They approached the car with guns. Once they approached the car with guns, I stick my hands out the window. I'm announcing myself. I have my 3-year-old son in the car to please let me know what's going on. They never announce what's going on. They pull me out of the vehicle, slam me right away, maybe 2 or 3 times. After slamming me 2 or 3 times, then they handcuff me. All this is going on while my son is in the vehicle. After handcuffing me, they slam me again, put me in a hog-tied position with my hands and my feet attached. Once again, they pick me up by my feet at this point, drop me on my head and my shoulders. My neighbors are advocating for them to stop what they're doing. I'm asking the neighbors to call for more police to arrive on the scene. The neighbors are being threatened to put their cameras away, to put their phones away, or they'll be locked up as well, things of this sort. Once they put me back on the ground, I was in a hog position again. They proceeded to arrest me after that. They threatened to take my son to Child Protective Services. And, you know, once again, working in the community, I was just appalled.
Did they ever say why you were being arrested? What happened? What were the charges?
After I was put into the hog position the second time, that's when they announced to me that I was driving without a seatbelt. They saw me driving without a seatbelt, even though they detached the seatbelt from me when they removed me from the vehicle. And I'm even telling them, I said, well, you guys are plainclothes officers. You know, for those who are not familiar, plainclothes officers are not traffic police. You know, they're not pulling you over for seatbelts. They're not pulling you over for talking on cell phones and things of this sort. Plainclothes officers are officers that are looking for narcotics,
right,
that are looking for guns, and to protect the community in that facet. And I even notified them. I said, look, I can pay a $25 ticket, but beating me in front of my son and neighbors is just uncalled for. And then meet with the Tyrone West fam. We maybe was it 3 weeks later, guys, that we we saw you guys at the police precinct.
Yes, we were protesting, and that's when we saw him. Yep, so God is good.
So let me ask this question, and I think in the kind of 15 minutes or so we have left in this segment, to make sure all the voices get in here. Then back to Tawanda, Diane Bell. What you like to describe is one of the things we've been talking about a lot here, in the stories we've been trying to tell. Is talking about who Tyrone West was, the human being he was. Mm-hmm. What you remember is the boy you raised. Mm-hmm. Who was he?
Tyrone was a beautiful, beautiful young man. He always put his family first. He loved every member of his family. Tyrone had a love for football. Tyrone enjoyed sports. Tyrone artwork.
He was an amazing artist. I saw his artwork.
Oh, my goodness, the work that he'd done. This was an upcoming artist.
Mm-hmm.
He had so many big plans for our family with his artwork. Mm. And for them to have taken his life so horribly, I still have nightmares. I'm still in tears. I know I have to be strong because I have to be the voice for Tyrone. But nobody deserved to die the way he was brutally murdered. He was maced, he was tased, he was kicked, he was stomped, he was cuffed. They were still kicking my child in his head. He was screaming, help, help. He's asking for help from the police, and they're the one murdering him. I can't understand how much hate, malice that these animals had, that they stood over a man mm-hmm. while he's on the ground and continue to beat him with such force, such hatred. Mm-hmm. And they are still on Baltimore City's payroll. We still paying these animals. Mm-hmm. I cannot understand.
And they hide behind paperwork because the same charges and the same actions that they accuse me of are the same exact things that they wrote about Tyrone. So
same exact thing. It's just absolutely a big thing to cover up things. That's all.
Jamie, I'm glad you came back. You come here or not, I can see your feelings inside of just where you look. You don't say a great deal on the show, but let me just ask this question. I want to know what some of what Heber Brown was saying, or many people in the community feel, is that what you and your family represent are kind of a resistance to this that we don't see families often stand up and do. This to me is like a sea change in what we're seeing in Baltimore. Can you talk about what you're saying to the entire city about this, Jamie?
I just want to say that it's a year coming up Friday, but it just feels just like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. I remember the phone call that I placed to my mother and my sister before I found out about the incident. It was like I almost knew that something was wrong. I called and I said, "Ma, something is wrong with my phone, but I feel like something is wrong. This is the number where I'll be. Just call me. Just call me." And I got home and I found out the news, and then to find out that it was the Baltimore City Police Department was even more disgusting. I just feel like these officers are gangs with uniforms on. My cousin was unarmed, not resisting arrest, and they still continue to beat him. They beat him after he was gone.
Mark, can I speak to this family strength that you just spoke of?
You can, and then we do have a lot of people calling in, including your Uncle George, who's just called in. We want to get George Peoples on the air, and we have several callers calling in, but Abdullah.
I just want to reach out and ask the community to support the West family. It's rare that you get a family that's going to be as strong, as organized, as persistent as the West family. They definitely have unveiled a lot of ills in the community. And for all of those people that are advocating for their family members, had something happen like this to themselves, their family members, this is your chance to come on out and advocate, to break through. This is not about just Tyrone West. This is about the community as a whole in order to fix the ills that are behind closed doors. So come out and get your own justice, if not for now or injustice that happened to you in the past, in the future, to make sure things go right.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. People have called in a while back and been holding on. Also introduce George Peoples, Tyrone West's uncle, who comes on the show many times, and he's taken very close touch with this. George, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm glad you could take a little break from work to join us for a minute.
Yes, sir. How's my family doing there? How are they holding up?
Wonderful, family, wonderful. We blessed.
The strong family, they're holding up very well, and I think that they're gathering around Aunt Diana here so she can, it was very emotional for her to tell the story she did about her baby.
Yeah, well, that's true, Mark. This year has been a very, very trying year for my family. This year has also been a trying year for the community of Baltimore. And we just had a family meeting last night. And make no mistake about it, our family is not unlike any other family in Baltimore City. This tragic event that happened to us has tended to splinter and try and split us apart. But grace be to God that we have stayed together and we have stayed on the battlefield. In this war, there are many battles to be fought. But make no mistake about it, Mark, this family, we are not against them. When I speak of them, I'm talking about the Baltimore City Police Department, the Baltimore City Medical Examiner's Office, the Baltimore City State Attorney's Office, the City Council. We are not against them. What we be reminded that within them, there are those. We are against those persons who choose not to do the right thing, those persons who choose not to step forward when an injustice is done. We're doing this so that it does not happen to any other family in Baltimore. We cannot change what has happened, Mark, but my family has resolved to stay out there and try and effect the change, which is what we've done in the Baltimore City State's attorney's race.
And I think one of the things I want to open the phones here, let our listeners who have been waiting for a half an hour or so to get in here, at least a couple of them get into this conversation of 410-319-8888. And what George Peoples just said, I think, is very true. I think part of one of the reasons that State's Attorney Bernstein lost to Marilyn Mosby in this primary was because of the constant effort and push of Tyrone West's family to keep things the light.
Absolutely.
And discussion in the community that kept and it grew over a year. It didn't just happen overnight.
Yes.
So,
and I encourage all 5,000 of my friends on Facebook to vote for Marilyn Mosby. He had to go. And all 4,800 of my followers, get out, please vote. And they went and voted. And I just want to thank them again. And if any of these elected officials cannot do their job, we're going to get y'all out there too.
Well,
do your job.
If I might add, Mark,
mm-hmm.
The family from the very beginning has supported Russell Neverdon. We have supported him, but we were inclined and we were truly, truly committed to getting Greg Bernstein out of office
right.
by any means.
It's necessary.
So 410-319-8888. Let's go to Beth in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Beth. You're on the air. Beth, you're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Okay.
You there?
Hello?
You're on the air, Beth.
Thank you. I would just like to say thank you for having the family on the air, and thank you to the family. I think it's really important to note this family has been out every single Wednesday since Tyrone was murdered, and I would really like to urge the public to come out more to support them because it takes a toll on them. I don't know how they have the strength to do that. And I would just like to remind people if they could come out and support the family on Friday, at Kitmore and Kelway, which is in northeast Baltimore, from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock.
Thank you so much, Beth, and we will make that announcement again and have it on our website, 410-319-8888. Marie, you're on the air.
Good morning. Now, in great respect for this family, they have been good fighters. I want to ask this question. It's general. When you have a questionable a report from the autopsy, is it a good idea for them or others to get a second autopsy done?
Absolutely, but the kicker is we haven't even gotten the first one yet. It's 361 days. We have still not got my brother's autopsy report in its full entirety. We still have not gotten it. And speaking of which, this Wednesday, we're going to the medical examiner's office to protest at 5 p.m. sharp. We still have do not get it to us. They gave, what is it called, the preliminary? That was a preliminary report, but we want the whole entire autopsy. I want to know if my brother had broke ribs or whatever. We have not got my brother's autopsy report yet.
Your lawyer doesn't have the report yet either?
Not yet. No, we don't. We do not have it.
Well, as of today, Monday, there has not been a complete autopsy done for Tyrone West since the date of his death.
A whole year.
And David Sharpstein, the head of the Baltimore City Medical Examiner's Office, doesn't feel as though it's his responsibility or obligation to speak to any of these things to the general public or to us because he does not have a supervisor.
Well, we will make some calls to that office during the course of this week before the anniversary of the death.
Appreciate
and beyond that
that's
to
ridiculous.
See what answers we can get as well. As we did when the initial report came out and we had people who were forensic pathologists talk about what their interpretation was.
Yes, about this outside independent investigation. Right. We got nothing. We still have nothing.
Well, Mark, you on, and I have to thank you, Mark, for having the family on.
Yes, thank you so much.
With us from the very beginning of this, from the very onset, and you had noted and renowned people on your show, including the doctor from Johns Hopkins Hospital, who repeatedly disputed the medical examiner's report. I want to thank you for that. That has stood out front in a lot of what has been going on.
Yes.
Well, thank you, George. It's been an honor to work with this family and be associated with your family over this last year on these unfortunately in this way. But I want to thank you all for George Peoples call in, who was his uncle. Tawanda Jones, who is one of the backbone spirits of all of this, is Tyrone's sister. She's back in the studio again, has been here for every conversation we've had. Diana Butler, Tyrone's aunt who raised him up, is here in the studio as well. And Jamie Richardson, who is Tyrone's cousin, joins us once again in the studio. And for the first time, we've had Abdul Salam, community activist who was beaten up by the city police just before this took place by the same police. And along with the West family, suing the Baltimore City Police. Good to have you all in the studio and here in this conversation. I want to remind you all that on July the 18th, the family of Tyrone West and their friends are asking people to join them at 6 p.m.
6:30. We changed
6:30.
It. Yes,
okay,
we did.
6:30 p.m.
I'm sorry.
At the location of his death. 6:30 p.m. at the location of his death at the corner of Kitmore and Kelway Streets in Baltimore. At the corner of Kitmore and Kelway Streets at 6:30 p.m. this coming Friday, July the 18th.
Yes.
And on July the 19th at 2:30 p.m., Red Emmas will host a special sneak preview of a screening of a documentary titled Year in the Transmigration of Tyrone West. Please join the family this Friday, 6:30, at the point of his death, the place of his
death. And every Wednesday.
Kitmore and Kelway.
Every Wednesday.
And if they can join us this West Wednesday at the medical examiner's office, because we didn't forget about those jokers either.
West Wednesdays, and they're not. It's been a year, and West Wednesdays are
and
still
not
going
to stop.
On.
And we done been enduring all types of weather, all types of weather. We're not going to where the weather will not change us. The weather can change, but we're not going to change in our fight and pursuit for justice. And I just want to add real quick that I wrote a President Obama a letter, and long story short, he wrote me. He got the Justice Department to write me back, and they're ready to come in and investigate all this that's going on.
And I just want to say on behalf of Keys Development and Better You, Better Me, we're fighting for all of our children and all of the community.
Well, thank you all for being here, and folks joining.
Thank you so much, Mark. We love you. Thanks.
We love you all, too. Kitmore and Kelway Streets. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is DJ Faze. Our interns are Alex Boston, Maggie Dyer, Sienna Greaves, and Sam Saper. You can go to our website and find information about the West family and everything else we talked about here on the show today by visiting steinershow.org. Also get our podcast. You can also go to iTunes now and download the podcast of The Mark Steiner Show. For Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, celebrating 88 days of summer. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.